Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now. This is Star Talk, and I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson, your personal astrophysicist. And today, this is a Star Talk devoted to the first man.
Adam?
No. That was Chuck Nice, my co-host of The First Man.
Sorry.
Special edition of Star Talk. We're, of course, talking about Neil Armstrong and his first steps on the moon. And we're not going to do that unless we bring in an astronaut.
Wow.
I mean, and it's cool. I got on my Rolodex, I got some astronauts.
Wow.
And one of my favorites, actually, he is my favorite, but I don't want to tell
him. Oh, that's nice.
Mike Massimino. Mike.
Neil.
Dude, thanks for coming.
Chuck, thanks for having me. I'm so glad I could
This is on short notice. We saw each other just the other night.
Yeah.
We saw a preview screening of the film, First Man, all about Neil Armstrong. And I realize it's not about Neil Armstrong. It is Neil Armstrong's view.
Yeah.
Right? It's his point of view of who he was.
They captured his personality, what he was about, the way he approached his work.
Yeah.
It was. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, let me finish introducing you. So you're a former NASA astronaut.
Yes.
You're a mechanical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
You're a professor at Columbia University. And you're a senior space advisor to the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum.
Thank you for mentioning all those things.
Yeah.
Always good to see you guys, especially to talk about my boyhood hero, Neil Armstrong.
So did you guys know Neil Armstrong?
Can I finish introducing
Oh, you're still on this introduction?
I'm sorry.
Holy moly.
You're a veteran of two space flights. STS, which is NASA code for Space Transportation System.
Correct.
Oh, cool.
It
actually makes sense.
Does it? I thought they could just call it shuttle.
Shuttle mission 109.
Yeah, yeah.
And in 2002 and 125, that was a good one, in May 2009, the last servicing mission of the Hubble telescope, giving it life into the 2010s.
That's right.
And you've had four spacewalks.
Yep.
And you're okay. He's the first man unto himself.
Yes, he is.
The first man to
tweet from space.
Oh!
Nice.
Take that, Neil Armstrong.
Yeah.
Okay, so Neil Armstrong said, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. What were your first tweet from space?
Yeah, that's the problem. There's a Neil Armstrong story here related to it.
Okay,
I don't know if we want to go there.
Yes. Go.
The very first time Neil Armstrong came to speak to my astronaut class. We were there for a total of 4 days.
So you're still like an astronaut cadet or something?
Yeah, we were just getting he was
total
there.
Total newbies.
He happened to be in town for his physical. Our training manager reached out to him. In Houston. Right, at the Johnson Space Center. All new astronauts. And she asked him, Paige Molesby was her name. She gave a message over to the clinic, would he come speak to us? And he said he would, but he only wanted to speak to the new astronauts. So he came over and talked to us mainly about flying in the X-15, and we asked him questions.
But the X-15, the test plane from NASA, based on a military...
It's a rocket plane. Yeah, and it was one of the more, maybe the most successful experimental aircraft ever built. They went Mach 7. A couple of those guys.
Seven times the speed of sound.
Yeah, and a couple of those guys earned their astronaut wings.
For having done
altitude.
So.
Yeah, that's how high this airplane could go. It could get you to what, space is an arbitrary boundary. That's another story.
Right.
But they were able to earn astronaut wings in that
Earth
in that
itself
aircraft.
Is in space.
Yes, yes.
Have you ever been to space?
That's another story.
Yes, I'm on Earth.
I hate to bring this up because then we'll have a whole other show going here about the boundary of space, but an amazing aircraft. He talked about that and other things, and we got to meet him and talk to him. But the day after, we were at a luncheon going on because there was a reunion as well as him coming in for his physical, and I ended up next to him on the food line. Making a sandwich.
Damn, and even Neil Armstrong had to go on a chow line.
Wow.
That's cold.
That doesn't even seem right.
That's wrong.
It wasn't bad food, though. Even though it was government food, it wasn't. Anyway, so he's next to me. I said to myself, I had to say something to this guy. Because I'm next to him. I don't know how it happened, but serendipitously. And I asked him, when did you think of that first thing that you said on the moon, the one small step for man? I go, did your wife tell you? Did you get a publicist? How'd you come up with this? And he turned to me and he says, well, Mike, I thought about it only after we landed, because if we didn't land, I wouldn't have to say anything. It wouldn't make a difference. And so I concentrated only on the landing.
Saved his brain energy.
Well, but I think the message he was trying to get to me as a new astronaut, or I don't know if he was trying, but the message I took was, you take care of business first and you worry about that stuff later. Right. So his focus was landing on the moon. So for my tweet, I did the same approach. I said, I'm not going to worry about this first tweet. We have to launch into space. We have to get there alive and successfully.
I got a job to do.
No, big mistake.
This sounds
like a
mistake.
This was a mistake. Sorry. So I get there and it's, all right, we're alive and it's time to, the computers are up and running on day one. And so I need to come up with something. So what I tweeted was, launch was awesome. The adventure of a lifetime has begun. I'm feeling great, enjoying the view. Something like long, but the
That's
first,
okay.
the first, it was okay. But during the mission, I was paying attention to the mission, of course. Mm-hmm. During the mission, sidebars, I didn't get any email from my kids. My kids were both teenagers. I love my kids. They were both in high school.
I love my kids, but
they were very happy that I was away from the planet at that time, and they were ignoring me. And I'm writing them, you know.
Well, they could have taken it personally. Some dads go on a business trip.
No.
You left planet Earth.
They were happy I was away, okay. And they were like, "Dad, annoying dad can't bother us anymore." And I wasn't getting
Where's
any
dad?
Email.
Is he in New York or is he in space? Which right. Where did
they,
he go?
Well, they knew I wasn't there, and they were just happy enough. They didn't want to be reminded. So I wasn't getting an email from him. Saturday comes, and Saturday Night Live makes fun of this tweet, Neil. And this was in 09, so it's the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11. And Seth Meyers on SNL says, we have the first tweet from space, Mike Massimino, and here it is. Launch was awesome. In 40 years, we've gone from one giant leap for mankind to launch was awesome. If we ever find life in the universe, I assume this is how we'll be notified. And it shows my little Twitter thing, and it says, geez, dudes, aliens. So wow. They made fun of me, and my kids finally sent my email on that Monday. They sent me email on that Monday, and I was, you know, after the spacewalks were over, like, Dad, I thought, thanks for saving the Hubble. You did great. No, it was, Dad, they made fun of you on Saturday Night Live. All the kids at school loved it. Keep saying stupid stuff. So I don't think Neil Armstrong ever got a reaction like that from his kids on that. What he said.
That was the first tweet. Was bad advice for you.
No, it was still good advice. I still think it's good advice because his advice was you take care of business first, and that's what you concentrate on. And I think that's the way he was, and I think that's why he was chosen to be the first man.
If only he had followed it up with, and make sure you schedule your tweets.
This story and others we can find in your book, Spaceman.
Yes.
Spaceman.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks for that plug.
Of course. It's not,
thanks.
That's a plug. It is a plug, but it's an authentically conceived, you're a great storyteller, and I love the book.
Thank you.
And you didn't fix the cover photo, though, because you're sitting there smiling.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And there's a rocket coming out of your ear that's launched behind
you. Well, I was told the publisher's in charge of the, you can have input for the cover, but I was in charge of the words and inside.
It looked like you had earwax with a plane
coming out
of it. I know,
I've heard, and in fact, if you see I've heard other comments, which we can't mention, about what that looks like. So yes, I agree.
So the two of us saw a pre-screening of First Man, and everything I know about Neil Armstrong, because I knew him, I mean, I don't claim I knew him well, we weren't beer drinking buddies, but I mean, we were acquaintances, I should say. Mm-hmm. And everything I knew about him, and I think is true for you, all that you knew about him, all that you knew of him, was consistent with how he was portrayed in this film. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, wow. Everything that I knew about him.
So give me your best characterization of him, because some people don't even know that.
I would say that he loved flying airplanes. He loved doing his job. He loved being a test pilot.
He was a fighter test pilot. He was a fighter pilot.
Fighter pilot first.
In Korea.
Yep.
Then test pilot. Yes.
Then a test pilot. He was, I guess, a very thoughtful engineer, but loved flying. When he came and spoke to our astronaut class,
he's got that engineer club.
He saw it as an engineering problem, as a challenge, and that's why I think he was not just a great pilot because he loved flying, but also a great test pilot because he enjoyed the engineering behind it. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty impressive.
I had never thought about that.
Yeah.
You could be fly boy, say, "Give me that machine. I'll do what I get." Yeah. But if you're an engineer, you're thinking about the machine,
right?
And if the aerodynamics,
yes.
And if you're really into that, like he was, I think it was this. And not all great engineers, I think, can make great pilots, but he was one of those that could. And I think that's where you have a really special test pilot.
And do they ever make a change to the plane? And he says, "No. That ain't gonna work."
I'm sure he chimed in. I would expect that those conversations were made, and especially back in those days when they were doing things that were much different than what they had ever done before, and how fast they were going, how high they were going, what they were trying to achieve.
Right.
When his test pilot days, I'm sure there was a lot of those conversations. Yeah.
So I would add to that that mm-hmm. Neil Armstrong was not gregarious. He was a very quiet man.
Yeah.
Did not seek publicity.
Yep.
Did not, you know, he's not the person who'd say is the life of the party. Yep. But sometimes the people who are not the life of the party are sitting there doing nothing. He's sitting there in his head mm-hmm. figuring stuff out. It's the active, restless brain of the engineer.
Yep.
And so this was surely captured.
That was him. And when I first met him, Neil, you described that really well. When he got up there in front of we all stood up and gave him a standing ovation. And just about all, I was one of the younger people in that group of new astronauts in 96. So just about everyone in that room, maybe one or two wouldn't remembered where they were. And that episode of what he did, landing on the moon, that whole mission, inspired most of us to become astronauts, I would say. We all remembered it. And
so you're meeting your hero.
We're meeting our hero. And it was just me, it was everybody. And he's the man, right? He was the man, and he gets up there and it seemed almost like he was painfully shy, almost that it was hard for him to talk, and he didn't mention the moon at all. He talked about test flying and how important that is and how you have to be diligent about it and how much he loved doing that. And after he was done, when we got the questions and answers, then we started asking what was it like on the moon. Mm-hmm. But up to that point, he was delivering that message, almost painfully shy, but he loved so much what he did and felt it was so important that that's what he focused on. He was the right man for the job.
Do you think NASA chose him to be the first on the moon because of all of this? Because he does not seek publicity? Because if they got some grandstand in,
mm-hmm.
yo, look at me, I'm on the moon.
Yep.
Here's my book about me being on the moon. Here's my talk show interview.
I've got a need for speed.
Yeah. You mean like if it was one of us? Is that what you're basically saying?
Do you think they thought that through?
I think that
they needed someone humble.
You know, that seems like a, you know, I used to think that. And maybe at first, but I think lately in the last few years, I've changed my thinking of it because I think that's almost too much thinking. I think really what they wanted to do, no, really, you know, I think what they were looking for was the guy that would get that.
I think that was
too
much thinking.
No, because
you overthink it.
You start thinking too many things like, oh, this guy has wearing blue and this guy, you know, you overthink it. I think what they saw was this was the right man to land on the moon. Whether or not he was gregarious, whether or not he was shy, whether or not, whatever those personality traits were, he was the right man because he understood what was happening. He was going to focus on that job 100%, not be distracted. And maybe that has partly to do with the fame seeking, but I think really he was chosen not for that, for the personality part of it, but because he was the right man to do that job.
So did they choose who actually got out of the capsule first?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that's the whole thing.
But he was the mission lead as well.
The mission commander.
Yes.
He was the commander, that's right.
So it wasn't because he was commander that he got to go first. They actually made the choice like, you're going to be the first to step foot on the moon.
And your commander.
Like, those are two separate things.
You think.
Yeah, and for example,
it could have been like in Star Trek. Yeah. You go check out the glowing blob first.
Right.
Buzz, you check, see that glowing thing? Right. Report back to me.
Right.
And then I'll step off the... Right. Off the
and that's traditionally...
You're going to be the black ensign from the Enterprise.
But that's the way we did it. Now that you're saying it, that's why I spacewalked, apparently. Because that's what we would do in the shuttle program. The commander and the pilot would not go out and spacewalk. The mission specialist would. And
mission specialist is someone who has an expertise, usually a scientific or an engineering expertise, brought into the service of the mission.
Correct.
So you're not flying a plane.
We're not there for landing.
We're
not going to land. I mean, we're part of landing, but we're not actually going to land.
Right.
Because the idea is, what happens if your commander goes out and doesn't come back? Who's going to land?
Right. But it's okay if you go out and don't come back. You can still land the
bird. I hate to put it that way, but yes.
We
used to brief our spacewalks, you know, there was a lost crewman. There was a line. Everything you would check, like, all right, this is in place, you know, this check, that check, that check. And part of the briefing was lost crewman. And lost crewman was a procedure we had to go rescue a guy that comes lost. And what we would do, sort of kidding around, was lost crewman, don't worry about it. We got three more. That's what we could get because we had four spacewalkers. So that was like the joke. And we'd all laugh, but underlying, like, hey, you know, you kidding? Come get me. But we were going to do that if we needed. what were we talking about?
The commander who went out
first. Yeah, the commander.
And traditionally, I think in Gemini, what they did was is that the commander would
Gemini,
not go outside.
Two astronaut capsule.
Right, and that's when they first spacewalked. Ed White was the first spacewalker. And Buzz was one of the last spacewalkers in Gemini, but I think it was traditionally the commander stayed inside. Yeah, thank you. But mainly the command. I think the tradition was the commander stayed inside, and it was the pilot who went out and then came back because the only one guy at a time going. So this was a different case where you're going to have both people going out for the walk.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, part of the authenticity of the film was. There are little details that they didn't have to really care about, but they did.
Yes.
So there's a moment. I happen to own an Omega watch that was gifted to me by Stephen Hawking.
Wow.
And
that's pretty nice.
Yeah. I don't mean a name drop.
I was going to say, I just like the fact that you didn't name drop.
Yeah. I've got one too, but I had to buy it myself.
Right. I have a Stephen Hawking watch too. He just doesn't know I have it.
Well, you got his watch.
Yeah. He was just walking around just like, you got to see my watch. Who has seen my watch?
So
it was gifted to you by you.
Exactly.
So, I got the Stephen Hawking Award for science communication. And so it's only like a year old, but this
cool, man.
This introduced me to Omega watches. Yeah. Omega was the first watch on the moon.
Right,
they were chosen by NASA after NASA got all the premier watch, the Rolex, Breitling, whatever the top watches were of the day. I wonder if they threw in a Timex. I don't know, just to get America in there.
I'm sure they did.
Okay, so they throw
and
it
it's
in.
Probably still on the moon, taking a licking and keeping on ticking.
Nobody remembers that advertisement.
It was a windup.
Right. No. So,
in fact, the moon watch was a windup. Right. But go ahead. Yeah.
So they put them all in black boxes each and scrambled them and then shake them, baked them, heated them, radiated them. And at the end of the experiments, the Omega still had the correct time.
Wow.
So Omega is our watch. And so they still milk that today with their advertising.
Yeah.
But in any event, in this festival that I attended, the Starmus Festival that Hawking is a organizer of, Omega was one of the sponsors, and so this became the watch.
Yeah.
It's engraved on the back.
Yeah.
But I saw a watch that looked very much like this on Neil Armstrong's hands
right
in the
man.
Movie. It's right there.
I'm wearing it.
You're wearing it. You're wearing that watch.
Yeah, I have.
Show the camera.
And did you get this from being an astronaut?
No. So we had Omega watches on the shuttle, and the way it was explained to us, like how they won that competition, was the crystal. Apparently that crystal that they had on top was almost impenetrable and you could do whatever you wanted to it. It wasn't going to crack. So particles are a problem. So that's why I think
and with moon gloves, how do you wind a watch?
Well, I think you have to do wind it ahead of time.
Okay.
Well, we had a different Omega that we had. We had a different, we wind it ahead of time. We had a different Omega for the shuttle. This is the moon version. I had a different one that I had to purchase. Now, Omega was willing, I think, to give us these watches for free, but it was a government program and NASA said not so fast.
Not allowed, yeah.
So we had to buy our watches, but we were able to purchase them from Omega and then fly them. I'm not wearing my shuttle watch and I'm wearing a moon watch that, yes, I had to go into the Omega store and buy.
Man, that is messed up, man.
No,
you can't.
Okay.
No, otherwise, you can be
it's
bought.
The right, yeah.
It's the right
it's
thing.
It's the right thing to do.
That's how you want it to be. You don't want it any other way.
It's the right thing.
We got to take a break.
Yeah. Okay.
We got to take a break.
All right.
You are listening to, possibly even watching, Star Talk. This is our first man edition, celebrating the life and the first steps on the moon of Neil Armstrong. We'll be right back. We're back on Star Talk, First Man Edition. And I've got First Man. Who's the first man? Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon. Got our friend of Star Talk, Mike Massimino. He's been in space twice. One of them to repair my Hubble Space Telescope. I love you, man, for that.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Chuck Nice, co-host Chuck.
Yes, and I've been in space. I'm still in space. I'm still in space.
Space out and being in space, two different things,
two
Chuck.
Two different things.
I was asked back in 2009 to host, to MC the 40th anniversary of the Apollo landing.
Yikes.
1969 plus 40 gets you to 2009. It was in the Air and Space Museum. It was there, and I forgot, Mike, what I did in front of you.
You moonwalked.
We had every living moonwalker in the audience in
you
front of me.
You said some interesting things there, I remember.
I
no, you said something about being the 40th that I thought was
anniversary. Yeah,
yeah, okay. And you were saying how 40 was an interesting number because 50 you might not, you know, and we've lost so many of those guys then and now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And,
wow!
And you did the moonwalk, which was great.
It's, you know, I don't dance
in public.
Wait a minute,
let's go back to the 40 because that sounds a little, you know, provocative.
I'm trying to remember if this is when I said it. 40 is an interesting number because in many stories, they don't track it beyond 40. So 40 days and 40 nights.
Correct, yes.
It's not 50 days and 50 nights. That's 40 right. days and 40 nights. Jesus got 39 lashes, not 40, because 40, that's like infinite.
Right.
You got to bring that in.
Okay.
You don't want to kill him. Right. You just want to hurt him.
Oh, that's the one lash that would have did it.
The one that's... what else? Just the number 40 shows up, especially biblically.
Yes.
Yeah, and, there you go.
Okay.
And it's a, so when you pass 40, it's like more time than historically people reckoned.
Okay.
You sort of, you know, all one right. through 40 and then infinity beyond that. And so beyond that, it's like, okay, is it still there for us to remember or do we have to be reminded of it? Whereas if it's within 40, you can talk about it. People are alive. They right. were conscious. They were adults. They were, so.
That makes sense. That's two generations, basically.
Yeah.
And beyond two generations.
You're stepping into the next generation.
You're stepping into the next generation, yeah, yeah. And that makes perfect sense. Okay,
so I think that set the mood at the time that this was a really special night.
Thanks for remembering that. In this event, afterwards, StarTalk was in our first year. And I said, this is a target of opportunity for me to get a bunch of interviews and we can make a show out of this. So I waited till the event was over and we had a reception and all of this. And I got interviews with various key people in the space program at the time, as well as some old timers like Neil Armstrong. And he Ooh. Never gives interviews.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen him interviewed on TV?
No, yet? That's one of the things he's known for is not being a big talker.
Here's why I think he granted me the interview.
Because you moonwalked?
I first met him when I was 14.
Oh.
On board the SS Canberra. En route from New York City to the coast of Northwest Africa.
Holy cow.
To observe a total solar eclipse, the longest in the century. And he was one of the various sort of important people brought on board.
Right.
First, they would enjoy the eclipse, but right. also they were there for the rest of us to interact with. And this is 1973.
And you're 14?
He's 14. I'm 14.
Are you by yourself?
Yeah, I'm by myself. I lied.
Did you stow away?
What did you do? Yeah, I was going to say, what were
you stow away?
Yes.
Did your parents know you were going on this thing?
They're like, wait.
My parents didn't even let me take the subway back then by myself.
Why does that suitcase
have legs? Like, you went on a cruise with Neil Armstrong to see an eclipse when you were 15.
I brought my telescope with me that I bought. From
I got to go to a ball game and I was excited.
Dog walking money. I had my telescope. I had my camera.
Wow.
And
awesome.
There were 1,500 people. They took off all the shuffleboard and the lounge chairs, mm-hmm. and it was a forest of tripods on this. The whole ship was a scientific floating vessel.
Wow.
And he was there. It's when I met Isaac Asimov and various other sort of heroes, if you're a geek kid
right.
in the day.
Wow.
And
no, that you so, and he was sitting. Kid. You were. Let's. You were a king geek, okay? You were king of all geeks. Because a geek kid is just like, I can't believe I just got this new trading card. You're like, I'm going to North Africa with Neil Armstrong. Like,
for the eclipse.
You kidding me?
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead.
So he's sitting alone at the bar. And this is 1 year after the last mission to the moon, which is 1972. It's 4 years after he walked on the moon. And he's alone. I said, you know, Mr. Armstrong. And I had my ship program with his picture and, right. and the thing. And I said, would you mind signing? Well, I don't know. Could you sign? I think. And so he signs it. And and I just said, thank you. When I next saw him, I showed him that I was on this vessel.
Right.
And I think he, I don't want to project what he might be thinking, but I think he saw that I became
no,
somebody.
No, there's an instant connection. Yes. You come to me all these years later with a signed program from a ship that you stowed away on so that you could go to North Africa and watch an eclipse.
Right.
That's pretty cool. I would have rather the story ended with him going, pull up a stool, kid.
Yeah.
But that's you what like scotch.
That's what it takes, kids, to get an interview with Neil Armstrong. You know, you're not just going to, well, hey, I've got my press credentials here. No, that's not working.
So, and it was brief, but I have it. And you'll see he's not a, you know, he's smart and calm and measured.
Yeah.
And let's check it out. Cool. This is my interview with Neil Armstrong, brief though it was. Neil Armstrong, commander of the Apollo 11. How old were you 40 years ago today?
I was 38.93.
Excellent. I love it. And of the entire Apollo era, what's your most indelible memory? And it could be your own walk, but if not, I'd just be curious.
Most indelible memory was approaching the moon and flying through the moon's shadow so that the moon was eclipsing the sun and we could see the corona all around the moon. It was not circular, it was elliptical, which was a big surprise. I didn't understand that. And then we could see the moon, the dark side of the moon, of course, illuminated by Earthlight, and we could see the craters and the valleys and the plains in a blue-gray three-dimensional view that was spectacular.
Texture. The image had texture.
And remarkable, but imperceptible to a camera, but the human eye was wonderful.
And the last question, what do you think NASA should do next?
I'm supporter of the NASA plan. I'm
just needs more money, I suppose, but the ideas are there.
Yeah, I think the approach they're on is a good one.
I like that. That's a very pilot. The approach here.
They're a little below glide slope, but you know they're gonna get there.
All right, Neil Armstrong. Thanks for those three questions.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
You guys never interviewed, and I felt like I was even taking too much by asking just those three questions.
Yeah.
I'm kind of giddy.
He was really into that second, what's the indelible. You could actually, I can almost feel him looking
experiencing
at the,
it.
Yes.
Experiencing
like it.
It
was really, you know, very visceral, his recounting.
And consider that's nothing you're going to get on this side of the moon.
Yeah.
Right? So it had to be the backside because he would have studied all the maps and the pictures and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, one of the things that that I noticed with the movie that I like, one of my favorite
First
Man movie, was that you're able to see what it looked like. And I think they probably did it pretty accurately because the film that we had back then in 1969, we had some, but especially of the approach and the landing, there were cameras kind of looking out that triangular window and the dust kicks up, but you really don't get an appreciation for what it was like to see outside. Can you imagine now if we were able to do that with a bunch of GoPros or whatever they would stick on high def cameras, we would see that moonscape and probably even the night passes.
There'd be a GoPro every foot.
Probably mounted so, right? You know, and
make
it's easy, right?
Make the whole ship out of
GoPro. Probably do that. And now, even in the low light level on the other side, I'm sure they could have found something. You know, they would have been able to do something. And because just recently, now we can get great images of the planet at night from station, for example.
And if it wasn't clear, his point that the eye catches it but the camera doesn't, is because the eye in one glimpse can get a very high dynamic range. So the moon can be very dim, but the solar corona could be very bright.
Right.
And you can see all that at once. Where the camera is going to commit to either the bright corona or the dim thing, but you're not going to get both.
Right.
And he's experiencing both.
And that description he gave you allowed us to picture what it was like. And there's no real good video of that, but his description of it is what we have to go
so
with.
It's so cool. Like,
You can feel that he'd rather just not be interviewed. Right? He would just want to go on his way.
Yeah.
But is that really the best person to have represent the fact that you have walked on the surface of a celestial body?
That's a good question.
I've heard one of his, I heard Mike Collins at Neil's memorial.
Mike Collins, the third astronaut who didn't get to go down to the moon.
He orbited in lunar orbit in the command module while Neil and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were on the moon. I heard him speak at the memorial. I don't want to misquote him, but at Neil Armstrong's memorial when he died, and they had a memorial service for him at the Johnson Space Center, and he talked a little bit about that, about him being maybe shy and cerebral or whatever. But he was like, "Well, why wouldn't you want that? Why would you this man who was so qualified, who did such a great job? Why would you want him to be anything different than who he was?" And I think he was the right man to land on the moon, and I think that was what they were most concerned with, because no kidding, they weren't so sure they were coming back from that mission. They weren't sure so sure they were going to be successful. Apollo 12 and 13, 11, 12, and 13 all had the same mission. They all trained for the same mission because they weren't so sure 11 was going to be successful, and then it was. And then 12 had to come up with something quick, which was different than what they did on 11. But they all trained for that same mission because they weren't so sure 11 was going to be successful.
What you're saying is if 11 failed, then...
12
next up,
you okay. try it. Right.
You're next.
Wow.
Right. And if 12 failed, didn't work, 13 next. Was going to try it. Wow. And that can be in a few different ways. One, not so that they would get that they wouldn't come back alive, but they might not get down to the surface and come back. They would have to abort and then come back to Earth. So it was really important for them to try to get the right guy to be the first guy. And that's what they went with. Who's the best guy to pull off the landing, especially of this?
And that's where he had ice in his veins. And by the way, there's a misconception, I think, about the first comments from Houston after he says, Houston Tranquility Base here, Eagle has landed.
Yeah.
Okay? Which means, of course, the first word of the first comments from the moon is Houston.
But there you go. And a plug for Houston, Texas, my former home.
The planet Houston.
Yep.
So, Houston. Tranquility Base here.
That's Eagle the way we talk. Landed.
Actually, there was some other contact light and other things.
Yeah, contact, yeah.
Right. But Houston then says... something like, congratulations, you have a bunch of guys down here who were about to turn blue.
Yeah, that was okay. Charlie Duke.
Okay.
Yep.
You think they're saying that because they just landed on the moon. That's not why they're saying it.
They were holding their breath?
Yes, they were holding their breath, but it's not because they just landed on the moon. That's not why.
Okay, why were they about to turn? Wait, they were Smurfs. No, I'm sorry. I had
because Neil was not happy with the original landing spot. And he only has a certain amount of fuel to prevent himself from crashing down onto the moon. This is keeping them buoyant. Yeah. Nope, too many boulders there. Nope, too many boulders there. And you see the fuel come down. Wait a minute. And then he keeps going, oh, I think I'll go over there. And my boy is smooth. Yeah. Let's wait, okay?
Yep.
So it's like he's looking for parking in Midtown.
He's looking for parking. He can't park there.
I can't park there. Right, baby, you think I can fit in there?
No, try over there.
But if you don't make it, you got to go home.
Wait, go ahead. So then he finally finds a spot, lands, there's like 1 or 2% fuel left.
Yep.
That's what they, because if he went to zero, because if he lands with fuel in a place that he could crash because it's not level, that's bad.
If he keeps looking,
he can't get home. If he keeps looking and runs out of fuel, he'll crash because he runs out of fuel.
Well, he might have aborted.
Oh, they could have still aborted.
I don't think he would.
You just jettisoned at that point.
I think that's what they would have done.
Forgot about that.
Okay.
So...
which is not a good deal either.
So he, with just... and they capture this in the film, in the tension. So that's why everyone at Mission Control was freaking out.
Oh.
Because that's the mission might not complete. Not because, we're happy you landed. Yes, we're all happy you landed on the moon, but we're happy you landed on the moon alive.
Yep. Yeah, he was down to one. They had a low fuel light came on, 30-second fuel or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And in the cadence of, which is depicted in the movie, but the cadence of the calls he was getting from Buzz, so many forward, so many down. And I think he was talking about rates at that point.
Yeah, it's rates. Rates down.
Right. Forward, five forward to give him an idea of how fast he was moving forward. Mm-hmm. So because he's all out the window, I would think, at that point. And that's the cadence of him coming down here.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah.
So I got to agree, if your mission is to succeed, that has higher priority over any social profile the person is going to have.
Or public relations.
Right. Yeah. Did you succeed first and worry about the rest of that later?
Right.
And his friends, his colleagues have John Young was still an astronaut when I became an astronaut and later walked on the moon. Alan Bean was his office mate and his colleague as well, another moonwalker. And I've heard him and those other guys say Neil was the right guy for the job. If they had a pick out of who they knew was going to get that job done, it was Neil Armstrong.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take our next break. We're talking about first man. That's the first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, when Star Talk returns. We're back. Star Talk, first man edition. We're celebrating the life of Neil Armstrong and the moon landing and his first steps. Got Mike Massimino. Mike.
Neil.
Very good. I'm just still laughing, chuckling at your first tweet
Oh, boy.
What was it? Yeah. Golly, I'm in space. Was that what it was?
No. Launch was awesome.
Launch was awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're, I should
Maybe
have thought more about it.
Maybe they misunderstood and thought you meant lunch was awesome.
No, that was the first day in space. No lunch yet.
Oh.
You're not feeling that great. Yeah, lunch was awesome the next day. That's when I wrote about the macaroni and cheese. This first day was lunch.
So at NASA, there's a famous, colorful character called Gene Kranz.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who is portrayed famously in the film Apollo 13, saying what?
Failure is not an option.
Failure is not an option. I bumped into
him. Did he say that in real life?
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's the legend.
Okay, cool.
Okay. And I bumped into him with a microphone in tow, first year of Star Talk. I'm getting all the interviews from all these space folks at this celebration of NASA's 40th anniversary for landing on the moon
in
2009. Let's pick up with my conversation with Gene Kranz. Here with Gene Kranz. Failure is not an option, Gene Kranz. That's your middle name now?
That's been a good game plan for most of my life. I really came into failure as not an option well after I started the business of Stars and Stripes Forever. When I was going through flight training, I had a very bad night. My first night solo, I suffered almost disabling vertigo. And finally got back landed, and the next evening you got to go out and do it again. And there's a story about you got to ride the horse that threw you. Well, I was fortunate that as I was sweating it out, chain smoking, lucky strikes, the flight line public address system came alive, checking it out for the Saturday parade, and they played the Stars and Stripes Forever. I picked up my parachute, aced that night flight. In fact, I aced the business as a cadet. Graduated, went to fighter weapons school, and from that day on, every day of my professional life started with the Stars and Stripes Forever.
There's a inspiring. Everybody's got something that gets them going. For most people, it's a cup of coffee.
Neil, I start off with a cup of coffee too, but the Stars and Stripes, it was interesting. I look for something that. Very slowly builds the energy, builds the crescendo, such that when you hit each day's work, you're at the peak performance and you remain there throughout the day. I found out that basically, from my standpoint, psyching yourself up is the key to success. Believing that you can, believing that you will. And then when you fall down, believing that you can pick yourself up and start all over again.
I want to ask you three questions.
Okay.
You ready? How old were you 40 years ago today?
I was 36 years old.
You were a baby.
I was a baby. My teams in mission control averaged age 26. The majority of those were kids fresh out of college. They had a couple of years training. They grew up in the Gemini program, early Apollo. They lived through the disastrous Apollo 1 fire. And they became tough and competent. And that was the fuel, the energy for the fire that took us to the moon.
What is your most indelible memory from the entire Apollo era?
Neil, I would say the most indelible thing were really many things. They were the personalities of the people. I had young kids that came in fresh out of college who had this dream of space. I had the engineers come in who developed the initial trajectory work, John Llewellyn and Carl Huss and Tecwyn Roberts, who are absolute pure mathematicians, and they reveled. This world.
So most people
was
just
life to them, and basically, I was a dumb engineer. I was a dinosaur, but my business was not to know the work that they did to the level they did it. My job was to be able to ask the right questions and watch the clock. I counted cadence for mission control.
So most people who only see the astronauts have no concept that of all this that's going on behind the scenes that's making it happen in the first place.
Well, the mission control team has the responsibilities for planning, training, and operate. And when we have problems during the course of the mission, we have to come up with solutions that allow you to continue with the plan that you had. And if that is not possible, to come up with another plan that is just about as good.
One last question. What's the primary goal you think NASA should have going forward?
I believe NASA should go back to the moon and then on to Mars. I believe that it's very important. You know, to me, the moon is like the boundary in the Mississippi River. We've been across there a few times. But really, think about the development that took place out west. Think about Lewis and Clark going out to the Pacific. Think about the business of exploration and those things that we learned and developed and discovered out there. But most importantly, I think it is a human thing. Exploration is a process that must be in every person's mind. It has to be part of their personality. It has to be the kind of thing that makes them want to get up and go to work each day and discover.
So, back to the moon, onto Mars, and beyond.
That's right.
You got it.
I'm go for it. Go for launch, Neil. Okay?
Excellent. There's only one Gene Kranz.
Effing love that guy. I love him.
You want that to be the voice in Houston when you were in the universe somewhere.
I want that to be the voice of everything. That guy is
Gene,
amazing.
Will we be okay? Yeah. You will be fine.
I'll tell you what you're going to be. You're going to be absolutely terrific. That's what you're going to be. Neil, I want to tell you, I like coffee. I like my coffee as black as space. But I use the stars and stripes as the sugar in my coffee. And I wake up every morning to coffee and stars and stripes. It's tremendous.
That's America.
That guy is awesome. That dude is awesome.
He's really the guy that you want looking out after your ass.
Really?
Right, what it is. Right, I mean, when you're up there in space, you want to know that you're the man in charge is going to make sure you're okay and is going to consider it most important.
He didn't mean God in that case, the man in charge. He meant Gene Kranz.
I meant Gene Kranz. No, the man in charge, what I really mean is the flight director. Right. The flight director is the person who oversees the team that is looking out for you. And that's what I always felt. You have a certain connection with your launch flight director. In this case, I think Gene was the launch flight director for... And Mike Linebeck was a guy that launched us out of KSC, and then our launch flight director, my second mission, Norm Knight, and Tony Sakachi was the guy during the orbit. And there was
an orbit guy.
We had an orbit guy. There was an orbit guy for Apollo 11 as well, right?
Yeah,
But they all followed, I think, in Gene's steps, and that was what you wanted. You wanted someone who was
so the right stuff.
Make sure you were coming back.
The right stuff wasn't only the folks who flew; it's the folks on the ground.
Yeah. Yes, and they take it just as personal when something happens. As anyone else involved, their job is to bring you back more than anything.
Now and I know where that saying comes from.
You want
from
a
too.
Guy like that? What's that?
Now I know where that saying comes from.
What's that?
Failure is not an option. Yeah, you hear people say that all the time.
Right. You didn't know it was Gene Kranz?
I didn't. I thought it was like a movie quote.
I didn't
know it's a movie quote because it's quoting him.
Oh, it's the title of his book, I think, as well.
Show's not an option.
Oh, man, that is
You got to go get this book.
I'm going to go get him. Are you kidding me?
Get it on audio book.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope he narrated. Oh,
Chuck is like, his eyes are popping out of his head.
Really, I love Chuck that guy. Like, this dude, he's like 76 right there when you're
he's
talking
still around.
To him. He's and even at 76 when you're talking to this guy, he sounds like a 22-year-old kid.
Right, with excitement. Yes. And
I love that.
So, Mike, did they level with you what your risk of not coming back was? Because... they made a point of this in First Man, that these risks are real, and we saw others die. Apollo 1, 3 astronauts died on Earth.
Wow.
There are test pilots who have died. Mm-hmm. So this is a specter over your choice to participate.
I think they tried to be as accurate as they could
and honest
about it. Yeah, and I remember it more because I flew on Columbia as the mission right before we lost Columbia. And then I flew again after on Atlantis, both shuttle flights. And I don't remember there wasn't as much talk beforehand. I guess it wasn't maybe as much on our mind as it was after the accident. We lived through that. After the Columbia accident. But the number I remember being told was about 1 out of 75 chance. And they weren't saying we want you to know this number. It was more like, this is our new calculated probabilities.
I was told it was like 1 in 50.
Well, I think there was 1 out of 75, and that was total destruction. That's loss of crew and vehicle. That's everyone's dead, and the vehicle can't be used again. There are other odds that may be of
they folded the odds of reusing the vehicle with the odds of you coming back alive.
Yeah,
that sounds pretty crass.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but when we lost Columbia, we just didn't lose our 7 friends. We also lost the spaceship and what happens to the program. So there's a loss of crew and vehicle. Now losing, but it's not so much about, it really isn't crass, I don't think, because you can lose the vehicle but save the crew. So if you have an abort with the shuttle and it ends up in the water as you abort, hopefully the crew gets out alive. So it's a combination of loss of crew and vehicle. It was about 1 out of 75. And as it turned out, we had 2 accidents at 135 flights.
That's one.
That's probably how they came up with that number, quite honestly. But but it was one out of 75 of total loss.
And do you think about it at all when you're, or are you just too busy doing your appointed duties to even let it cross your mind? I took a flight back to New York from Detroit yesterday morning, and the whole time I was like, God, I just hope these people know what they're doing.
Sometimes you're worried more on a commercial flight than you are doing anything. Yeah. At least we had it. Absolutely. I did. I don't know if everyone does, but I knew that that there was a very good chance that something might not be coming back.
Wow.
And I think in some ways that's a good thing to know.
And the movie captured this poignantly with his relationship with his wife and his kids.
Yeah, and I think they also showed the after was successful. How wonderful it was for to have the accomplished
that we had succeeded.
Yes, that we had succeeded. Mm-hmm. And Alan Bean tells us this story that after Apollo 11 and after his mission, it wasn't the whole world. His impression was the whole world. It wasn't like you did it or the U.S. did it, but we did it.
We, the human species, did
that,
it.
Yeah, that motto, they came for all humankind. Let's change it a little bit, right? For all humankind. I think that's the way
we
everybody
come in peace
felt. We come in peace for all humankind.
For all over.
And that's the way I think people felt about it. It was an accomplishment that for that humans that showed what we could do, and the whole world was a part of it, and they felt it was an accomplishment for the world.
I was had the privilege and honor to be invited to Neil Armstrong's funeral service in Ohio after he died, and the moment was solemn, of course, but it was also celebratory. There were reflections on Neil as a person. And one thing that came across was, Neil was the right guy for this job. And because if he started grandstanding this achievement, then it would be like he landed on the moon. But in fact, we all landed on the moon. It's our collective first step on the moon. Tens of thousands of engineers and scientists and hundreds of millions of taxpayers. We landed on the moon. And what did he do when he was done? He became Citizen Armstrong again. Became a professor. Went back to Ohio, where so many astronauts have come. Became a professor and shunned interviews. And I'm reminded, was it a Roman emperor? Cincinnatus, after whom Cincinnati is named, Cincinnati, Ohio.
That's where he taught.
He came to become emperor, and when he was done, he went back home and continued as a farmer. Didn't exploit the fact that he ran all of Rome. He didn't grandstand that fact. He was called into service. He gave of himself, his time, his energy. Sacrifice whatever was necessary for his home life. When he was done, he went home. That's what Neil Armstrong did. He came home to us all.
It's pretty cool, man, I have to say. I understand it for Neil Armstrong. Cincinnatus, got a problem with him.
What? What's your problem with Cincinnatus?
I'm just saying, you know, you were ruling all of Rome and then you became a farmer. What's your problem, buddy? Are you kidding me?
The Roman Empire?
You want a Roman Empire at your disposal?
It's a reminder.
You go back to farming?
It's a reminder that some people want power for power's sake rather than power to lead and guide others in a time of need. That's a cosmic perspective. We got to end it on that. Mike Massimino. Yeah,
thank you.
Always great
and
to have you, man.
And thanks for doing this for Neil Armstrong. He is, I think the things you said, especially at the end there, I think those are lessons we can learn for all of us, no matter what your occupation is, how to approach things. And he was my hero as a little boy because he landed on the moon, but getting to know him a little bit as a person and learning more about him, that's when you realize what a true hero he was. So thanks for doing this and having me a part of it.
And Chuck, Gene Kranz is his hero now. So
I'm just so happy for
not
this
the Cincinnati
show.
Guy.
No,
Cincinnatus. No,
Cincinnatus. No, Gene Kranz forever.
There you go. Right.
That is all I'm saying.
This has been Star Talk. most of you are listening. Some of you are watching. I've been your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. As always, keep looking up.